Appearances can be misleading. Case in point, I've been traveling by air for most of my life. And as I've traveled by air, I've always noticed the people who tend to get to go on the plane first. They are part of what most airlines would call the elite class. Those who are frequent flyers. Those who have racked up a lot of miles and who get those special perks like priority boarding and priority seating and all of those goodies that come with traveling frequently. So imagine my surprise when, in the midst of traveling from Montana to California back and forth for my work, I wake up one day to an email informing me that I am now a member of the elite class on Alaska Airlines. They actually call them MVPs. And that made me feel even a little bit more important. And class distinctions aside, which kind of is a bit unnerving to me already, I thought, oh wow, well now I get to enjoy some of these perks that some of these elite, and I viewed as somewhat entitled people, get to enjoy. And then I began to enjoy them. And then I realized how nice it was to get those perks, especially when you're flying a lot. And before I knew it, my chief aim in air travel became, how can I hold on to those perks for as long as possible? How can I maintain my status? And it began affecting my decisions regarding how I would book my air travel, how I would spend some of my resources. I needed to use my Alaska card to keep getting those miles. And before I knew it, it wasn't so much something that I enjoyed as a gift, but it was something that I came to expect when I traveled. And it also became something I was fearful of losing. I mean, gosh, priority boarding, priority seating, an occasional free upgrade if it's available, and best of all in Alaska, MVP chocolates to all who ask. What am I going to do? I started noticing this when I was checking into my flight. I'm flying later today to go back east for a few days of study leave this week, and I realized my MVP status is about to expire. And I don't have enough miles to keep it going. So I thought, what do I do now? Do I hoard all the chocolates I can? But it really made me wonder, how did I get to this place in my travel life? Most of my life prior to becoming an MVP, I didn't really need the perks. I traveled, for the most part, just fine. What caused this change in my perception? What caused this transformation in the way that I experienced air travel? What caused me to fear for losing something that for most of my life I hadn't had? Jesus is traveling on his road towards the big city, Jerusalem. And what's awaiting him there is not nice. But he stops in the city of Jericho on the way. Now, last week's story involved a religious leader, a Pharisee, and a tax collector. Well, this week we don't have a story. We have an encounter between Jesus and a chief tax collector, Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus' name literally means righteous one. And given the reputation of tax collectors in that day and age, I'm wondering, is it a play on words? The tax collectors were not revered in ancient society. If anything, it was the opposite. They were seen as crooks, criminals, thieves. Because often in the Roman system, tax collectors would skim some extra money off of the top of what people were already paying for taxes to keep for themselves. Especially if someone was late paying their taxes. Someone who was deeply indebted would benefit the tax collectors even more because they would usually skim off some of that interest that they were paying for themselves. Zacchaeus was part of a corrupt system. And regardless of his heritage being Jewish, it still was hard not to be perceived as being part of that machinery, that unjust and corrupt system. And so there is Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector in town. Not exactly the guy you want to invite over for Thanksgiving. And yet he wants to see Jesus. Clearly he's heard about Jesus. The word of mouth has been spreading. And I wonder, does he want to see him so badly because he's heard that Jesus is, quote unquote, a friend to sinners? We also know from the story that Zacchaeus is, let's just say, vertically challenged. And so, knowing that the crowds are going to jam in around Jesus, he needs to find a place to see him. So he climbs up into a tree to get a better vantage point. Now, Zacchaeus knows of Jesus, but he doesn't know Jesus. But as Jesus is walking by, you get a very clear impression that he not only knows of Zacchaeus, being the chief tax collector in town, but that he knows Zacchaeus. He calls him out by name. And what does he say? "Hey, Zach, get out of that tree right now and go repay all of those people you've been swindling." It's not what he says. He says, "Hey, Zach, come on down. I want to come to your house for dinner and a nightcap." Not what we were expecting. Probably not what Zacchaeus was expecting. And yet Zacchaeus was overjoyed. And he popped down out of the tree and came over to greet Jesus. But as he did, he heard those voices that are all too familiar to him. Grumbling, "Sinner, wretch, reprobate, criminal." Jesus hears those voices too. Voices that he's been hearing for most of his ministry as well. "Sinner, lover, how dare you hang out with one of those types? One of those people who have defiled and corrupted themselves." So Zacchaeus overhears this, and as he greets Jesus, he says something surprising. "Half of my possessions I give to the poor. And if I've defrauded or been connected to defrauding anyone, I repay them four times the amount." But didn't we just read something else? In our scripture for this morning, it says that Zacchaeus offered to Jesus, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. If I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." If you look at the original language, there's confusion. There's complexity. And it's one of these cases where scholars used what I would call interpretive license. Because all of our interpretations in English come from these ancient languages, and some of the words in those ancient languages are complex and difficult to discern. They can be taken different ways. But when you look back at the actual words in the original language, the tense that they are in is not future. It's present tense, present progressive tense. The word didomai literally means "I give." Apodidomai means "I pay back." So what is Zacchaeus actually saying here? Zacchaeus isn't making a promise to Jesus. Could it be that Zacchaeus is telling Jesus what he's already been doing? And if so, what does that mean for those people's perceptions of Zacchaeus? Could Zacchaeus here not be asserting his own self-righteousness, But could he be defending his life against false assumptions, false accusations? And could Jesus here not be offering him forgiveness, but vindication, acknowledging Zacchaeus' true identity as a child of God and as someone who is living out of that identity as a child of God? Could this come back to core identity? That underneath his vocation, underneath the assumptions of others, even the assumptions of himself, I imagine, from time to time, Jesus is saying, salvation has come to this household today because he is a child of Abraham. Which is Jesus' way, perhaps, of saying that not only is Zacchaeus a child of the Creator, but that we all are. Today, salvation has come to this house. Isn't it already there, if this is the case? Doesn't Zacchaeus already know who he is and whose he is? Isn't he already living out that identity? Why would Jesus say this if this is what's going on? I wonder if Jesus says this not for the benefit of Zacchaeus and his family, but for the benefit of the onlookers, the judgmental crowd who have already been judge and jury and decided who Zacchaeus is because of his job title. Could Jesus saying that he has come to seek and to save the lost mean that he has come to reach out to the scattered, the dispersed, the cast off by judgment from others, by self-judgment, and to draw all of those back to that core identity, to remember who they are, to remember whose they are? Appearances can be misleading. One of the things that I have been pleasantly surprised by in my air travels as an MVP is meeting other frequent flyers, people who are in the air almost as much as they're on the ground because of their work or for other compelling, necessary reasons in their lives. And I've been astonished because my preconception of frequent flyers was of people who have great means and people who are somewhat entitled. And then I meet a young businessman whose work has been to work with an organization who is creating opportunities for people in impoverished nations by providing microloans, by providing small amounts of money loaned to people so that they can start businesses in those impoverished areas and find a way out of that cycle of poverty. And to hear some of his stories about why he's traveling so much. Or to meet a woman who's a doctor who spends an increasing amount of her time working with the organization Doctors Without Borders. And to hear her tell the story about how Doctors Without Borders gradually over time took more and more of her time. And she was spending less of it at her practice because the work that Doctors Without Borders was doing was so compelling and transformative and life-giving. She wanted to do more of it. She wanted to get more people involved in it. She wanted to make an opportunity for younger physicians and medical professionals to get involved and come on board and make a difference in areas where healthcare is so scarce and so underfunded and so desperately needed. I started realizing that maybe my perceptions needed some adjusting. I started realizing that Perhaps there are two sides to this coin. That the people I assumed were consumed by their perks and success often are actually and privately more generous than I am. And that I'm realizing that once I have something I didn't have before, I then feel like I can't live without it. And I'm holding on to it more tightly. Appearances so often can be misleading. How difficult it is for us to remember our core identity, to remember that we are all children of our Creator, and that the life we were created to live is a life of love and welcome and giving. And I think of that incredible children's story by Shel Silverstein, The Giving Tree. And how moving that story is to me, and I know to many others. And yet there's such a tinge of melancholy within it. Because here's this tree that grows up, and the boy loves the tree, and the boy plays in its branches and eats its apples and is happy. And then the boy grows older and needs the tree less and less. And so the tree gives more and more until all that is left is a stump. And the boy comes as a very old man and says, I don't need a house. I don't need a boat. I can't eat apples with what's left of my teeth. I just need a place to rest. And the stump straightens herself up as best as she can, and with a smile on her face, gives the boy a place to rest. This is a tree who knows who she is and lives her life in the way it was created to live. She lives to give. She recognizes that she's more fully herself when she's generous. When she doesn't let anything else distract her from remembering who she is and why she exists. Maybe the story of Zacchaeus is a reminder to all of us of who we truly are and how easy it can be to forget that. Maybe the story of Zacchaeus is an invitation not only to remember that we are loved and that we are created for love, but that all we are given, life itself, all of our gifts, our time, our resources, are that, gifts that have been given to us, not to be clung on to, but to be given away in love. Maybe the story of Zacchaeus is a chance for each of us to be surprised and delighted by the fact that things aren't always as they appear to be, and that in our heart of hearts, through the eyes of love, we are all MVPs.